Hello and welcome to the Unsung Podcast, introducing the sports stars you don't know, telling the stories you can't miss. My name is Alexis James and we've got a special episode for you this time around, which was recorded live, yikes, as part of the 2025 Mortworth Book Festival in March. It was great to be part of the event alongside some big name authors who actually know what they're doing. Because it was recorded live with no retakes, you'll hear the occasional cough, mumble and awkward silence, and that's just from me. Hopefully, you'll make it past the 20-minute mark when my 7-year-old in the front row produced a colouring book from a bag. Clearly, not her first rodeo. The talk itself is titled Not All Heroes Wear Kits, and it's something of a whistle-stop tour through a few of the unsung characters I've written about, including one or two that podcast listeners may be familiar with, alongside others who I'm speaking about for the first time. And, like a pound shop Marvel villain, there's a little bit of backstory that goes into the how and why I've gone into telling these unsung stories from outside the mainstream. So, without further ado, let's head to Mortworth, Northumberland for Unsung Live. Not all heroes wear kits.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for coming along today. It's much appreciated. It's an honour to be on the bill with such distinguished authors in the big house over there. So thanks to the organisers for that. Lovely to see so many family members here today. I was just thinking I probably could have done this at Uncle John's and saved you all a fiver. Now, just to give you a rough idea as to what I'm going to do for the next hour, I appreciate there'll be some of you here who are familiar with me work. Hi, ma'am. And others not so much. So what I'm going to do is a bit of a whistle-stop tour through my podcast, the book here, and then a new publication that I'm excited to share with you in a bit. And just so you don't get bored of my voice, I'm going to intersperse it with a few clips of the interviews I've done and also some of the sporting moments that I'm going to talk about. But before I dive into those stories, I thought it would also be worth talking a bit about why I write about the people that I do. And I've never really shared much of that before, but I do think it gives a bit of insight as to what motivated me to talk about the topics and subjects that I write about. And lastly, just to let you know, in case you're wondering why there are so many mics, I am also intending on recording this so it'll go out as a live episode of my podcast. Now, that's nothing for you to worry about, but I will be editing out any yawning, okay? So I've got a lot to get through, so let's crack on. So why Unsung? Now, the first thing I want to do is transport you back to 2008, February 2008 to be exact. Rockstar by Nickelback is the number one in the charts. No Country for Old Men has won Best Picture. And Northern Rock is being renationalised as part of the global financial crisis. But the biggest news in sport is that Fabio Capello has been appointed as the new England manager following their failure to qualify for the European Championships. Now, before his first game in charge, Capello and a few of the England team have invited a few journalists along to a kit reveal to show off the new England away kit. Now, one young journalist arrives to interview David Bentley here, who you see on the right, who you may not remember, but he was the Tottenham winger who at one point was being touted as the next David Beckham, who had been controversially omitted from the squad, from the England squad. Now, this excited young journalist had a list of 30 questions to ask David Bentley in an interview that would be filmed for a digital magazine with their page-turning technology, which felt really innovative at the time, but as we now know, was completely unnecessary. Now, if you haven't guessed, the bright-eyed and bushy-tailed young man who was there to interview David Bentley was me, in my very first job. That's me looking really professional with the FA Cup at FA headquarters. Now, I still have that list of questions for David Bentley because I had to send it to the FA at the time. And the topics were pretty wide-ranging. I was looking at it the other day. I was going to ask about Capello's lack of English and how that might affect communication in the squad. I was going to ask about the tactics that Capello could use to get the best out of his underperforming players. I was also going to ask who Bentley thought would be a good captain in David Beckham's absence. But the question I was most looking forward to ask was, of all the bad England haircuts of the past, which one would you choose out of Chris Waddle's mullet, Kevin Keegan's perm, or Bobby Charlton's comb-over? Paxman, eat your heart out. But the thing is, when I got there, one of the press team handed me an edited list of my questions. And of the 30 questions I'd submitted, 22 of them had been crossed out. I wasn't allowed to ask about Capello's grasp of English, nor what tactics he might use, or even who the next captain would be. But my heart truly sank when they put a line through the haircuts question. So we'll never know if David Bentley, whose head was shaved that day, shared my preference for Waddle's mullet. And so the interview that transpired was this.
Was it mainly fitness?
Yeah, he got us at it and that. And yeah, it was a good experience, to be honest. It was a good training. I enjoyed the training session, yeah. Obviously, you want to be successful, you know, you want to play. And But yeah, you want to win the World Cup, you want to win the Euros, and it is possible. And it's just about doing it, and
yeah,
no good talking about it. You've got to produce on a football pitch. So.
Now, I've had to cut that short because it's too early for a nap. As you can see, David Bentley's bored. I was bored. And judging by some of those camera angles, the cameraman was bored as well. Now, this isn't a pop at David Bentley. Far from it. He was perfectly pleasant, actually. It's not his fault that he's been asked to do a dozen interviews that morning, and he's had to answer the same questions over and over again. And it should be no surprise that when that happens, all you get is banal clichés and forgettable platitudes. Now, the irony is, one of the other questions I wanted to ask David Bentley was, do you think the public find it hard to relate to England's biggest players? That was crossed through as well. And while you might think I'm blaming over-officious comms team for it, I've actually got sympathy for them too. And here's why. You see, the following year, I was invited to Carrington, Manchester United's training ground, to interview Michael Owen. It was for Betfair, which was a brand that he was endorsing at the time. And sat with me in the club canteen was a tabloid journalist who was also there to interview the striker. But the night before, Owen had picked up an injury in a Champions League match. So he was late to the training ground. And while he underwent treatment, you know, it would be a couple of hours, and I was in no rush. They were giving us free pastries, free coffee, and I was watching some of the best players in the world in training. But this tabloid journalist, who's a fairly big name in the industry, was getting increasingly tetchy. After a few hours, we're told that Owen's not going to make it. He's got too much treatment to do, so he won't be in today. But they offered to arrange a phone interview at a later date instead. Now, I was on my fourth coffee by that point. I was like, yeah, it's fine. No problem. But the tabloid journalist, he wasn't happy, and he stormed off. I don't do phone interviews, he said. Now, a few days later, I duly called Michael Owen, and the interview went, as you might expect, nice enough, but he's not exactly a born raconteur. And so I published this fairly unremarkable interview on the Betfair website to little notice. Imagine my surprise then, the very next day, when an in-depth interview with Michael Owen appears in the country's biggest tabloid newspaper. Every quote used was from my interview, and the person claiming credit for it was, as you guessed, this angry journalist who doesn't do phone interviews. Turns out he just steals them. Anyway, I won't mention his name because that would be really petty. Not sure how that's got up there. The great news is the podcast listeners won't get that, and that tawdry gossip is why you lot have paid your fiver. Get in. Anyway, it got worse because the story spiralled, right? For context, Michael Owen used to play for Liverpool, signed for Manchester United. It's really rare, given the heated rivalry, for any players to do that. It means the players who do have to be really careful with what they say. Now, Michael Owen knew this, and his answers were fairly dull. Basically, I asked him how he felt about signing for Manchester United, and he told me that he was happy to be at one of the biggest clubs in the world. But when the papers reported it secondhand, they wrote that he was happy to be at the biggest club in the world. Now, it's a small but notable difference, and boy, the football fans notice. The Evening Standard, the Daily Express, the Times, the Telegraph, and the Manchester Evening News all ran the wrong quote, and the Liverpool Echo were fuming at the disrespect. The Belfast Telegraph even had it alongside a feature of the 10 best mass insults. Michael Owen was forced to play down the furore based on something he never said to journalists he'd never spoken to. And so for me, the media paranoia I'd experienced at the England camp a year earlier suddenly started to make a lot of sense. I was just a young and naive journalist at the time, less a deer in headlights, more one splattered across the windscreen. I'd seen both sides of the story and neither were pretty. Now, there's a big caveat here, because much of this has changed thanks in large part to Gareth Southgate, particularly with the England camp. He did wonders at opening the communication and trust between the media and the players. And the result was one of the best-loved England teams in years, with characters and personalities allowed to emerge. Bukayo Saka on an inflatable unicorn will never fail to make me smile. But the reason I wanted to start this talk with those two stories was to give you an idea of the media landscape at the time that I was taking my formative steps in journalism. I had other similarly frustrating and unfulfilling experiences, including a telling off by Gary Lineker, of all people. Whatever you do, don't ask him what his favourite flavour crisp is. Now, while those experiences didn't put me off sports writing entirely, they certainly began to mould my approach to it. I wanted to find the antidote to the coddled and vetted sports stars away from the hyper-speed and hyper-sensitive nature of tabloid coverage, where quotes are blown out of proportion and the back pages are more soap opera than sport. So I found myself being drawn towards long-form writing and slow journalism movement in the likes of the Blizzard and Delayed Gratification, which were both established in 2011. Now, these are all about journalism that allows you to take a breath, take a beat. And I reasoned that humanity probably doesn't need another feature on Cristiano Ronaldo. So I started to look for the sports stories that had never been told before about the people who'd never before been asked to tell them. I wrote about the burgeoning beach volleyball scene in Edinburgh, of all places, interviewing these the Scotland's first ever beach volleyball team at the Commonwealth Games. There was the story of Clermont-Ferrand, the second division French football team, who became the first club in the world to appoint a female manager in charge of the men's team. I attended the CONIFA World Cup in London for unrecognised nations and sports isolated territories that are excluded from FIFA. And I met players from places like Tuvalu and Tibet. But I didn't ignore the big sports stories completely. I just dug for new and original angles away from the big name players and coaches. For the 2018 World Cup, I wrote about the photographers covering the event and discovered their unique experiences travelling around Russia. Now, some of these pieces were published by sports websites and magazines, but anything that was deemed too niche for mainstream coverage, I published it on my own blog, hoping that one day I could find a home for it. I called it Off Field, All About the Untold and the Unsung. Now, I didn't know at the time, but two of the features I worked on back then would become the foundations on which my book is based. Snow Whisperers featured the amazing scientists behind the scenes at the Winter Olympics who ensure there's enough snow to host the events, even if Mother Nature decides otherwise. And there was the feature on the Greenkeepers at the biggest event in golf, the Ryder Cup, where the best golfers in Europe take on the Americans. Now, these brilliant superintendents spend upwards of 5 years meticulously cultivating a golf course for the eyes of the world to descend on it for just 3 days. Not only can they prove incredibly influential on the event, but they've also got behind-the-scenes stories that nobody's told before or ever heard before. So I interviewed Ryder Cup greenkeepers past and present, including Steve Chappell. Now, this guy was in charge of Gleneagles in Scotland at the Ryder Cup in 2014, and he told me the story behind one of its most memorable moments. With Europe leading on the final day, Englishman Justin Rose has skewed left off the tee and he's landed in a gorse bush on the 13th hole. Now, 99.9% of people watching that would have just gone, bad luck. But there was one guy, one person in the world with his head in his hands thinking, oh, bollocks. And that was Steve Chappell. Now, the reason is, months prior, he'd intended to remove this very bush, but he was prevented from doing so by the European captain, Paul McGinley. Now, you see, at over 300 yards from the tee, McGinley figured that it would only be the Americans hitting it this far and who'd land there and get caught in the trap. Instead, it was Rose who was caught in the thorns. His American opponent, Hunter Mahan, sensed the chance to increase his lead in the match and halt the surging Europeans, but Rose had other ideas. His recovery to within a foot of the pin was one of the defining moments of the tournament, extinguishing American hopes. Rose smiled at the camera and quipped, there's a bit of Seve for you. He was right. It was a shot that the late, great Seve Ballesteros himself would have been delighted with. And here is the clip.
Mahan up short of the green, but what can Justin Rose do? Well, he obviously had a better lie than it first looked. Oh, that's a great recovery from Rose. What a wonderful shot. Oh, that is just fantastic, isn't it? How did he do that?
With a great deal of skill and a little bit of good fortune.
Is Seve for you?
Now, as you can hear, the Scottish crowd are cheering, the commentators are gushing, and one relieved greenkeeper has experienced that moment like no other fan on the planet. Now, the reason I'd written about these guardians of the fairway was because I was heading to the Ryder Cup myself in Paris in 2018. And as I arrived that morning, I noticed a battalion of greenkeepers driving right on moors on the green hills and golden dunes of the Albatross course. Clipped to each vehicle was a blue flag of Europe, fluttering in the morning breeze. It was a rousing sight, especially as I was a little bit hungover at the time. But for us lucky, bleary-eyed attendees, it was a sign that the Ryder Cup had begun. But for those two dozen ground staff, alive and alert, it had started many years ago. So as I watched that sprightly troop of greenkeepers fizz the way around lush Parisian lawns, I felt a renewed appreciation for these hidden facilitators. For years of toil, it's gone towards laying the canvas on which sport and greatness occurs. Now, throughout sport, there are hundreds of decisions made and actions taken by peripheral figures just like Steve Chappell. They help shape the moments that become TV montages, history book chapters, and lifelong memories. Yet too often their work goes uncredited and unnoticed. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to write a book that shines a light on these people in sport who quite often only get any attention when something's gone wrong? And so I did. Written in a year over a span of two lockdowns, the book features 12 chapters focusing on different roles in sport. I spoke to well over 40 people, I think, for it. There was Mikko Martikainen, Finland's original snow whisperer. Aina Fransman is the kit designer who changed the look of modern football with the legendary kit worn by the Germany, a reunified Germany side that won the World Cup in 1990. There's Tony Stones, the big Yorkshireman, masterminding Didier Deschamps' pitch at the Stade de France. Rachel Muse is the performance chef, fueling the Premier League's top players. Jason Jenkins is the motor pilot, who, thanks to him, we get to watch the biggest events in cycling on TV. Sports chaplain Mary Vickers played an integral role in women's sport and offers drop-in chaplaincy at some of the biggest events like the Olympics. The late Peter Clark is the interpreter who predicted the arrival of the Premier League's Foreign Legion. And then there's Olympic silver medal winning cox Zoe de Toledo. Last on this list is Colin Clues, who's a man so secretive I don't actually have a picture of him. Instead, he's represented by the unusual souvenir that he gave me, which are these anti-tamper Belinger bottles, which athletes must urinate in to test for performance-enhancing drugs. He has assured me these ones haven't been used, just in case you're wondering. But today I'd like to focus on three other roles in the book. And the reason I've chosen these three is because each was there at the most memorable moment in recent sport and history. They experienced that moment unlike anybody else in the world, just like Steve Chappell watching Justin Rose at the Ryder Cup. You might be familiar with these headline events, but as I like to do, I've taken the main focus of the moment and looked slightly out of shot. Now, it might make a terrible photo, but it's there that I've found the unsung characters at the periphery, allowing me to discover new angles on old tales, beginning at the Athletics World Championships in Berlin in 2009.
Away first time, good start from Bolt. Bolt leading the moment and going away. Gay trying to go with him and he's going, being dragged through to second place, but he's going to win it by 2 metres. 9.58, the world record's gone. That's more like it.
So the first chapter in the book is all about athletic starters and it felt apt to get things off with a bang. I spoke to the man who fired the gun that day in 2009 when Usain Bolt broke the world record that still stands today, 9.58 seconds. Now, most won't have heard of Alan Bell, but you'll have almost certainly heard his gun. The experienced chief starter has been in the voluntary post for nearly 50 years and he's had the best seat in the house at some of the most historic moments on the track. Usain Bolt's world record in Berlin was, as he kept reminding me, was the 17th world record that Alan's witnessed in his career. Among his highlights include being in London 2012, watching on as the likes of Bolt, Jessica Ennis, David Rudisha and Mo Farah made history. But while he's got stories to tell from all over the world, interacting with all-time greats, the thing with Alan, who's from Cumbria, is that he still volunteers his time to oversee local and youth events too. So when I met up with him, he asked me, oh, come along, we'll meet up to an event. And I got really excited thinking he might take me something like this. And he said, let's go to a junior meet at King Edward School here in Morpeth. I thought, all right, fine. And it was there he taught me the tricks of the trade. Now, the first objective is, he told me, whenever possible, go unnoticed, which admittedly can be tricky for someone holding a gun in public. But the idea is, if you do your job and nobody notices you, everything's probably gone okay. And that's a trend that is repeated throughout the book in most of the roles. And the other skill, he told me, was to study the idiosyncrasies of each athlete before they take to their blocks. So everybody knows what Usain Bolt's pre-race routine is, but it's up to Alan to know the routine of every other athlete in the race, whether that's hanging back, kissing crucifixes, exhaling loudly, or just yelling. Whatever it is, it's up to Alan basically to decide that he ensures that the race is won via feats of athleticism rather than unsporting tricks of the mind. Now, the other thing Alan told me was, it's vital to be scrupulously fair. Regardless of who's in the race, you've got to uphold the rules strictly, even if that requires making unpopular decisions. Now, brace yourself, because Alan's got a voice as booming as his gun.
You might find this hard to believe, but first of all, I take no notice of who's in the race. That's irrelevant. We're talking sprints. You've got 8 bodies. End of. You don't think about, God, that's Usain Bolt. God, I'm crapping myself. Or, that's Dwayne Chambers, that's the British champion. Oh, I've got to give him wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
And then it's about knowing when the time's right to summon the athletes and then fire the gun.
And the real skill in my job is you wait until everybody is at the pinnacle of their set position and they have all been absolutely still in that position. And when you're happy, they've all had that opportunity to get in the still position and concentrate, you pull the trigger.
And if you can do all that, you can become a world-class athletic starter. And all of those skills came into play for Alan at the World Championships in 2011 in Daegu, South Korea. It was here that he demonstrated how the role of athletic starter is about more than simply pulling a trigger. You see, 2 years after his stunning world record in Berlin, Usain Bolt was once again lining up in the 100-meter final. Daegu, like Berlin, was expectant. The city wanted its own page in sporting history, and Bolt was ready to write it. Enter Alan, stage right.
Then I pull the trigger. And, you know, it's fair to say, probably at a major event between set and pulling the trigger, I'm holding my breath. I'm holding my breath because I'm praying I don't have to pull the other trigger.
Now, in Daegu, Alan's prayers went unanswered. The dreaded beep sounded in his ear, and he instantly fired his recoil gun. Now, although he already knew who was at fault, he has to wait for the computer printout to prove that the data matches up to what he's seen. It showed that the athlete in lane 5 had moved before the gun had even fired, which is very rare to see. It was as clear a false start as you can see at the highest level. And I'll let you guess who it was.
Set.
False start. I think Usain Bolt false started.
No.
I can't believe it. I think Usain Bolt, almost unthinkably, has he false started? The reaction of Bolt suggests that that most emphatically is the case.
For the neutral of us here, now this is an open race because with him out of the picture, is it Bolt? Let's see. Yes, clearly. He goes.
Now, the crowd and the commentators were desperately wondering if Bolt could somehow be reinstated. But Alan was unmoved. His decision was final, but his next battle was about to commence because he was put under severe pressure from Korean TV producers. They were desperate to get the race back underway to avoid messing with their TV schedule. Now, an unimpressed floor manager stood only inches from Alan, insisted the race recommence immediately. Alan wasn't happy.
He's getting it in his ear. I'm only linked to the equipment, right? Thankfully. He's getting it in the ear from his director upstairs, and he's giving me jip, you know? And I just turned to him, I said, there, you start the race. I handed him the guns. And he just sort of looked at me. I said, we wait.
Bolt's training partner and fellow Jamaican, Johan Blake, was the ultimate beneficiary that night. He became the youngest ever 100-meter world champion at 21 years old. But for Alan, the story didn't end there. As he did at the end of every day of competition, he'd arranged to meet his wife, Leslie, in the VIP area after the race. Leslie, it should be noted, is also an athletics official.
I'm walking up to Zot Rosette and she's got a face like thunder. She's looking at me and I'm thinking, she knows I have no choice. I had to disqualify the guy. And then I suddenly realise she's sitting with Usain's mum and dad. And I thought, oh my God. So as I got closer, Mrs. Bolt stood up. And, I mean, she's a big lady. Usain got his mum's jeans, believe me. And I just thought, well, she's going to let rip at me. And you know, she was fantastic. All she said to me was, he made a mistake, you know? And that put me at ease. And then I just said to her, I said, well, I hope he can get it out of his system ready for the 200. And she just looked at me, she said, he'll be ready.
6 days later, Alan's recoil gun stayed silent for the 200-meter final, and Bolt made no mistake this time. There's his man. Now, he had a slow start, as you probably imagine, but he powered around the bend as only he could and comfortably took gold. So I asked Alan if, with an expectant crowd and anxious Korean production team on his shoulder and the world media having already written the script, if there wasn't a small part of him tempted to reinstate this generation's greatest athlete. And he responded without a moment's hesitation. He said the circumstances were very difficult, but that was the easiest decision I've ever had to make. But he still admits that disqualifying Bolt was the lowest moment of his starting career.
The lowest moment was probably the disqualification of Usain Bolt. Not because it was him at all, but because having to disqualify an athlete in the final of the World Championships, it could have been any of them, But the fact that it's an athlete who, like all of the people in that final, they might have worked for 10, 12, 15 years just to be there. It's sad that you have to apply the rule. Take no pleasure in it at all. Take no pleasure in any red card to any athlete, whether it's an under 13 in the Tyneside Track League or whether it be somebody in the World Championship.
Now, if you fancy the sound of that job, it is unpaid, but you get to travel the world and obviously meet some of the greats. And athletics is crying out for new blood. The day I was there with Alan, he was tutoring a guy called Mickey Baker, who was an up-and-coming athletic starter. Alan called him the next generation, the new kid on the block. It's Mickey in the middle there, 61.
We'll be back at the Morpeth Book Festival shortly, but first, a mention for the off-field newsletter. If you've enjoyed any of these podcasts, then do subscribe for free over at off-field.net. And every month, you'll get a curated selection of tales from the fringes of sport and society, the untold and the unsung. You'll also stay up to date with our latest storytelling projects in audio, digital and print. And on that note, stay tuned until the end of the episode for an exclusive reveal of an exciting new off-field publication. Now let's head back to the live episode as I seamlessly segue from the athletics track to the pit lane.
Now, there are no such recruitment issues for the next role I'd like to look at, Formula One mechanics. I went to visit the Haas F1 headquarters in Banbury, where chief mechanic Matthew Scott told me that a recent advert for a mechanic position had attracted over 800 applications. Unfortunately, only 20 of them had any genuine credentials, with the rest populated by F1 fans keen on a jolly. Now, from the outside, it's easy to see why. Seasons are made up of races in Monaco, Shanghai, Singapore, Miami, Melbourne, Las Vegas, and jet-setting mechanics are among the first on the scene on a Tuesday helping to construct pop-up garages. But despite the perception, there's very little time to explore your surroundings. As the guys responsible for putting away the toys post-race, the mechanics are also the last to leave. Usually they clock off late into the night on a Sunday, long after the drivers, engineers, media and fans have gone to enjoy the host city's hospitality. Now, the post-race pack-up is one of the least enjoyable aspects of the job as well, that's what they told me. It's like cleaning up after a house party when the rest of the guests have gone for a morning fry-up. And so it's not quite the year-round thrill that you might assume. Mechanics spend close to 200 days a year on the road. Along with the physical toll that takes on their bodies, the mental wrench of being away from your families for that long explains why the majority of them are sprightly souls on the right side of 40. The pressure of fine-tuning the finest margin in sport also takes its toll. For 99% of a race weekend, Formula One mechanics are behind closed garage doors, building, maintaining, mending, and optimising a machine that can travel at 200 miles an hour. Yet for barely seconds of it, they're changing its tyres in front of a global audience of 100 million viewers. That's the fastest pit stop ever recorded by McLaren, I think it was last season. They changed 4 11-kilogram tyres in 1.8 seconds. It takes me 20 minutes to put the kids' seatbelts on. The average pit stop now takes less than 3 seconds. Should a pit crew be on screen for longer than that, you know that something's gone drastically wrong. Now, this daunting mix of jeopardy and consequence means even a Fonzie-like ability to repair an engine blindfolded is no guarantee for a successful career in a Formula One garage. Mechanics who wilt in the pit lane are about as useful as a hiccuping surgeon. And so a cool-headed demeanour is what's required to do well. And that's not just for the pit stops, because in a sport played out at such ridiculously high speeds, anything can happen. Now, to demonstrate just how cool a customer this guy is, I'm taking you to the 2020 Bahrain Grand Prix. You might remember seeing it in the news.
This is after turn three, and you see Grosjean, one car out there, and then Grosjean to the right-hand side.
My God, it's torn the car in half. No wonder the fuel came out of it.
Yeah.
I said the fuel was in the middle of the car. Must have been instant. It's gone nowhere, has it? Look,
yeah,
it's gone
absolutely.
5 metres down the barriers. So just the retardation alone was enough. Now he's sitting in a ball of flames.
Romain Grosjean's race had ended less than half a minute after it had begun. As you saw there, the Frenchman hurtled off the track at a 45-degree angle. Back at the paddock, the engineers heard only one word before his radio cut out. Begins with an F, and my kids are in the audience, so I'm not going to say it, but you can guess what it was. Now, Grosjean hit that barrier at 119 miles an hour. As red flags waved and all the cars returned to silent pit lanes, the driver was yet to emerge from those flames. It had been 28 seconds, but to those in the pit lane staring at the inferno, it felt like 28 minutes. Mercifully, Grosjean had remained conscious. But despite being able to undo his belt, his left foot was trapped. And with the heat increasing and the flames testing the resistance of his race suit, he briefly accepted his fate. And then he raged against it. The gloves on his hands began to char, and he wrestled his way out and emerged from the wreckage under a shower of extinguishing foam.
And there we can see Roman.
So Roman's getting himself... Yeah, he was in the flames for a long time, wasn't he?
Absolutely.
Getting himself out.
And this is why they will perform extraction tests. The drivers and the FIA time the drivers in getting out of a car.
Back in the pit lane, hugs were exchanged, tears were wiped away, and Grosjean had escaped with only a broken foot and burned hands. Here's Matthew recalling the day.
His shoe was still in the car. Where the chassis had broken or it hit the upright of the barrier, the pedal had snapped off and the inside sort of caved in. His foot had got wedged between the chassis and the pedal and he couldn't get it out. So he did his damage to his ankle by pulling his shoe out of a laced boot.
Now, the spectacular crash and miracle escape made headline news. For viewers, it was an enthralling story with a happy ending. For F1 officials, it was vindication for their divisive safety protocols. But for Haas's chief mechanic, it was a problem to solve. Matthew, top left here, he took his team to the crash scene to help clear the car, or what remained of it. Some debris would be found 100 metres away, and some would be buried into the ground and not uncovered until days later. Now, at that point, there remained a real and present danger in the form of the car's 800-volt battery.
The car had just been converted to component pieces. It was one of the worst things I've ever seen. The batteries are anything from 600, 800 volts. At the start of the race, they're fully charged, and they're lethal anyway. But the battery had split open, so it was like hanging there, sizzling away. That someone had to take the responsibility of cutting through those battery cables. And so it was like, well, I suppose I've got to have a go at this. And you're there, stood in all this protective gear. You just go down and it's like, cut these wires. It's like, you don't know what's going to happen.
And so, like a Hollywood action script, this brave chief mechanic knelt down, hoped for the best, and cut through the battery's wires. As you can see, he lived to tell the tale. And he invited me down to the Haas garage. When I arrived, there was framed mementos that hung on the lobby walls, alongside signs forbidden photography. Oops. There was race-worn helmets, overalls, gloves, and a pair of Grosjean's boots, just like the one that had failed to re-emerge from the Bahrain bonfire. It was an instant reminder of what had happened to this team just 9 months before my visit. It'll go down as one of the most remarkable incidents in Formula One history. Matthew admitted that the crash was an emotional time for the team, which is one of the youngest in Formula One. Bespectacled, softly spoken, and analytical, he's not your archetypal, tea-slurping, oil-coated, potty-mouthed mechanic, but he is a typical Formula One mechanic. So he hasn't got to where he is by conducting stellar MOTs at his local Ford garage, but by embedding himself within the world of junior racing from the moment he could open a toolbox. He calls his work a vocation rather than a career. And he told me that working in F1 was less of a bobble hat, garage-dwelling grease monkeys going racing and drinking beer, his words, not mine. He said that it's now about technology and doing professional sport on an international scale. Now, that's not to say that this team is populated by Silicon Valley-style tech bros like Elon Musk. Matthew's voice could only just be heard over a sound system booming out dance tracks with an intermittent backing chorus of cackles and F-bombs. And a long workbench split the garage down the middle with the mechanics working on a car on either side of the divide. Now, at Haas, I found a team of grafters. Their budget works out at less than a third of what the podium regulars are spending. And their gritty, make-do attitude has previously defied the odds. But when I was there, they were a team low on morale. They were bottom of the grid, and they hadn't recorded a single point since Grosjean's near-fatal crash. Matthew may have delicately severed the wires of a searing battery that day, but the job of recharging his team was proven trickier. And if results didn't improve on the track, he admitted that his biggest challenge wasn't the car.
Certainly when you're struggling performance, it's the repetitive of it, having to still do the same job you would do if you were winning a race every day, but with no reward. It's not rocket science what we do, putting the car together. It's just that it's the repetitiveness of it and the traveling. And from my side, it's about managing the people, managing the expectations, I found the most difficult thing. A lot harder than working on a car. Having to try and motivate those guys when the rewards aren't there is very difficult.
Now, from the outside, we might consider an F1 mechanic as service personnel, a walking, talking driver's toolbox. But I found that they possess a competitive edge as strong as that of the guy behind the wheel. Through the eyes of an F1 mechanic, the driver is simply the final component that allows them to realise their own ambitions. In a very noisy garage, so brace yourselves, Matthew told me how the best drivers appreciate their team.
The better drivers, the more successful drivers, realise it's a team sport.
Yeah. Now, I'll read the rest of that quote because it is a bit noisy, that, isn't it? We are in a library after all. He says the most successful drivers realise it's a team sport. They realise that the recognition has to be more than just them. They haven't built the car, they haven't designed the car, they haven't set the garage up, they haven't had the car in the wind tunnel, they don't have the models, they haven't done the science. There are a lot of people all aiming towards that one goal, and a good driver understands that. And it was noticeable whenever I asked the mechanics about their favourite moments, they talked about wins, podiums and points in the first person, just like you'd expect a driver to do. They soak in every high and dwell on every low. Now, a few months after my visit, the first race of the 2022 season would take place in a neon-drenched Bahrain. Two seasons ago, that was the scene of terror and relief for the Haas team. And this time, there would only be the latter, and lots of it. A tenacious performance from driver Kevin Magnussen saw Haas claim an unexpected fifth place finish. And for the first time in 526 days, Haas's tireless mechanics were able to run to the pit wall and take in the sight of their driver, bringing home their car with their points in the bag.
Magnussen, welcome back to Formula One. He's fifth.
Yeah, that is P5, buddy. Welcome back, mate. I go slow. So still caution, turn one, double yellow. Awesome job, mate.
Same, man, same. That was perfect. Oh, man, thank you.
We made it to the end of the race. We got P5. I can't even believe it.
Driver Kevin Magnussen there knew exactly to thank when he was interviewed after the race. He said, it's so good to be back in this position. I've just got to say a massive well done to the team. Now, the last story I'd like to talk to you about is that of the rugby doctor. Unlike a pit mechanic who you often only see for seconds on TV, those watching a rugby union match will be accustomed to the sight of a doctor running on the pitch, or one running alongside it. Take this clip of George North's memorable try against Australia for the British Lions in 2013. As the pulsating winger reaches the 22-metre line, keep your eye out for a bald spotted figure in a green shirt and yellow band who can be seen just off the pitch, out sprinting the touch judge.
George North threw the first tackle. They tried to tap him but could not go to the outside. North for the corner. He's been unleashed. The Lions wanted to show the Australian public that they could play, and George North has just most certainly done that.
Now, that man pumping a blue-gloved fist into the air is Dr. James Robson. He'll be familiar to anyone who follows the British Lions as a veteran of many tours. He's famed for saving the life of Will Greenwood, who swallowed his tongue during the 1997 Lions trip to South Africa. And Dr. Robson retired after last year's Six Nations, but his energetic patrolling of the touchlines has become a common sight in over 250 test matches. And an impressive one too, given his ability to keep pace with elite athletes 30 years his junior. Now, having worked in rugby since 1991, the Scotland doctor remained consumed by the thrill of top-level sport.
Toughest part is not getting carried away with the game and remembering why you are there, but, you know, it's the care aspect. It's not getting carried away with the emotion of the day and actually staying calm enough to do your job. It's not about you. It's about protection of the player. Mm-hmm. So just do your job, get on, get back up. After the game, you can get involved and you can celebrate. Occasionally, I do put the fist up if we've scored because you can't take that element away.
Now, there was good reason that the doctor was giving chase that day because North had passed a late fitness test on his hamstring and the medical team were nervous about whether he'd be able to play. They'd worked tirelessly with the player for over 2 weeks in a bid to get him ready for the first test in Brisbane. And it was their judgment call, not the coach's, that he was fit enough to take the field. So when North caught the ball and had to run 60 metres to score, it was a heart-stopping moment for Dr. Robson and his team, nervously watching on to see if his hamstring would hold. And I think it's fair to say it did. This became one of the most famous tries in Lions history, which explains Dr. Robson's celebrations. But getting caught up in the occasion is only to be expected. Just like the players being selected for a Lions tour represents the pinnacle of a rugby medic's career. If you're on that plane headed south, you know that you're deemed to be the best in the business by a coach regarded likewise. Rugby union is one of the toughest sports on the planet. Since turning professional in 1995, the players are bigger, the game is faster, and the collisions are more brutal. And yet it's still one of the few sports where a medic can enter the arena while the game is still ongoing, which can be a little daunting. But despite the inherent dangers, Dr. Robson reflects on it as a privilege of being an active part of the match.
Once you're on the pitch, you've got to be immensely aware because play could very quickly come back to you. And players being players, they don't stop. They don't see you and they can go through you. And more importantly, if they've got somebody down injured, they could go through them. So we've had some close calls, but the best thing about my job is I've got virtually the best seat in the house. I have the privilege of being able to roam pitch side. Who else can be so close to play but not playing?
Now, as part of the chapter, I also spoke to Rachel Schofield at Newcastle Falcons, not far from here. And as one of only a few female medics in the men's premiership rugby, she was understandably not quite as quick to describe running on the pitch during play as a perk. She told me, I'm probably more conscious than anybody because if I get hit by them, I'll be broken in two. I've seen so many people get run over. It's very high on my radar that this is dangerous. She recalled one time where she ran on, saw oncoming traffic, and ran straight back off. And she said the players took the clip and set Benny Hill music to it. And while they can often be the butt of the jokes, Rachel described working with the players as like herding cats. But every medic I spoke to mentioned the changing room camaraderie as one of the highlights of the job. As they patrol the touchline for 80 minutes, they're closer to the players than any other members of the backroom staff. In fact, they often spend more time on the pitch than some of the bench replacements. And so given sport's tendency to find a competitive edge wherever possible, medics can often become a useful strategic tool. A player needing a breather or a coach wanting to halt the opposition's momentum may subtly request that treatment take longer than necessary. And so considering all of this, it's not unusual for some medics to be treated as just another team member. But that's not always as fun as it sounds. Dr. Robson, for instance, was once punched in the changing rooms by a player who thought he was being pranked.
Tell not to spray disinfectant on somebody's cuts without actually telling them. I saw they were just about to go in the shower, big rakes down the back, because in the early days, of course, rucking was allowed, so yeah. You could clear out the player with your studs. And I quickly just got a spray out, and I went to spray before seeing. Of course, it stung. The guy swung around, clocked me one.
You can see why a medic might sometimes feel like one of the players, but very occasionally there is an acute reminder that they are anything but. In February 2010, Scotland winger Tom Evans had gone off the Millennium Stadium pitch to receive stitches to a cut lip. When he returned to play, he ducked into a tackle, dipping his head to prevent the wound from opening up again, but instead it resulted in exposing the back of his neck. As Evans tumbled to the turf, the ball spilled from his grasp, and his immediate reaction was to grab the ball again, but he found himself unable to move his arms. Within seconds, Dr. Robson was there, ordering the other medics not to move the player a single millimetre. Now, few things can quiet in a raucous Cardiff crowd on Six Nations match day, but the sight of a neck brace and a stretcher will do just that. Evans's breathing was short and panicked, and still numb, he thought he was about to die there in his Scotland shirt on the pitch. Suddenly, he felt a thrust of pain in his legs and his back, which he likened to being hit by a sniper's bullet. Now, despite the agony, Dr. Robson refused to give him painkillers. The reason was, he figured they'll just relax him into moving in a way that might snap his spine. So here's the man in question talking about the day.
I kind of ducked my head due to my lip, obviously because it was in quite a bad state, and that's probably obviously the reason for what happened. I just remember going into the collision and spilling the ball and my mind wanting to reach out and grab the ball and obviously secure it, but obviously my body just not responding in any way possible, and you know, it was very scary times. And I just remember James Robson, again, just telling me to stay still and try not to move. And like I said, you know, like it paid massive dividends and, you know, I owe him my life.
Now, at the hospital, Evans's scan showed that two vertebrae were so severely damaged that the surgeons had to operate through the front of his neck. Before going under, Evans had to sign a waiver saying that he had only a 50% chance of making it through. Now, the 24-year-old was obviously forced to retire from the sport, but thankfully, he made an otherwise full recovery thanks to the decisive actions of Dr. Robson. Now, let's not forget those decisions have to be made in the moment in front of 70,000 people. So understandably, it took several months for Dr. Robson to fully process the events of that day.
I can remember for 6 or 8 weeks, every day driving to Murrayfield in the morning, and my thoughts were rerunning that scenario over the whole, you know, every time. You couldn't get away from it.
His calm but swift actions almost certainly prevented permanent paralysis or worse for Evans. And as you heard, he owes his life to the humble doctor. Now, he might have had to retire, but don't worry, because Tom Evans has done all right since. He's since gone on to enjoy a post-rugby career in music and television alongside his pop star fiancé, Nicole Scherzinger. And the doctor now smiles every time he sees his former patient on TV.
I love seeing Tom, and he's off with Nicole now, and he's having a fantastic life. The only piece of memorabilia I have on the walls in the house, despite being in privileged position over the years, is Tom's jersey that was cut off. It sits above our television, because every day I thank goodness that we were able to affect what we did, and that was down to training. And so that is a reminder to me how fickle life is. If you can be there and you can have that privileged moment of actually providing the necessary care, you can make such a difference to not only that individual, but their family and their friends and what happens for the rest of their lives.
Now, the next line from Dr. Robson features as the very last words in the book.
Medics worldwide do that every day. We don't do it quite so much in sport, but every now and again you think, wow, I did make a difference.
I thought that not only did that neatly sum up the chapter about the rugby medics, but also it encapsulated something about every person I spoke to in the book. What connects them all is they're unchampioned heroes who play a pivotal role in allowing us to enjoy elite sport. But they're not only hard workers and passionate about what they do, they're also the best in their field. They share many of the sports person's psyche through their discipline, training, and wanting to get to the top of their industry. And although they occupy the same room, track, or pitch as the biggest names in sport, they're often more relatable. They look like us, live like us, have flaws like us. They're not the media-savvy operators that modern sports people are. Questions aren't vetted. And they're not chatting to you because they're trying to plug something, unlike some. They're often unguarded, honest, and genuinely thrilled to be able to share the tales they rarely get to tell. And there's plenty more where that came from. In my Unsung podcast, you'll hear stories about volunteer lifeguards, Paralympic guide runners, refugee Olympians, and coming soon, an episode on the genius behind the tech that has changed sport forever. And while I continue to tell my niche sporting stories, I'm pleased to say that in recent years, some of them have found more mainstream homes. Two of my features were last year published by BBC Sport, and together the articles reached over 1 million readers in 24 hours. And that made me think two things. There is an audience out there for alternative sporting stories from the fringes. And two, just imagine if every one of those had bought my book. Wouldn't that be nice? Now, I'd like to end with a plug. This is a new book that certainly lives within the same ecosystem as Unsung. I've written the stories, and my good friend and longtime collaborator, Matt Walker, has designed this high-quality, limited-edition anthology celebrating the untold and unsung stories from the world of sport. Harking back to that little old blog I did many moons ago, it's called Off Field. Once again, it comprises a mix of sports, but if Unsung was devoted mainly to British stories, then Off Field cast its net far and wide. We span the globe to explore the diverse sporting landscapes beyond the familiar, presenting unheard voices from the fringes of the sports you love and the ones you didn't know existed. From the rugged cliffs of Bhutan, our beautiful cover story features an unlikely baseball odyssey in the Himalayas. We document pioneering photographer Graham Watson's 40 years on the back of a motorbike at Europe's biggest cycling events, and obviously features all of his photos, amazing photos in there. We journeyed to Dubai to take in the historic sport of camel racing, where the jockeys are robots, the best camels are cloned, and the winners are coated in saffron. We meet the Swiss artists reimagining the traditional football sticker. And there's more tales from rugby's treatment room as veteran All Blacks doctor John Mayhew talks about keeping Jonah Lomu's liver condition a secret years before his death. There's the pioneering female mechanic who smashed F1's glass ceiling. And probably my favourite story, we're also taking in Sweden's icy Baltic shores for the history-making swim-running duo conquering Stockholm's archipelago. Now, these little-known sporting tales are brought to life with striking photography, world-class design and premium production. We're only printing a limited number, but we're very proud of it, and we're taking pre-orders now for release later this spring. I think that's probably enough promo there. So thank you very much for coming along today. Your interest and support is much appreciated. Just to finish on a last question I've had submitted online from a young journalist who didn't give his name. He just wrote in to ask, of all the bad England haircuts of the past, which one would you choose? Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Unsung. This episode was recorded live at the Mortworth Book Festival in March 2025. Many thanks to everyone who came along and avoided the temptation to heckle or boo. Many thanks also to Ben Hobson at Mortworth Library for his tech expertise, and to Sarah Jane Kennedy Robson, Ian Leach, and all the festival organisers for inviting me along. If you're interested in finding out more about Offfield's debut print anthology that I mentioned at the end of my talk, head to off-field.net to enjoy your first glimpse. You'll also find a discount code in the show notes for all pre-orders. And if you don't already, make sure to subscribe to the podcast to be the first to hear new episodes. Unsung is an Offfield production written and hosted by me, Alexis James, and produced by Matt Cheney. Artwork is by Matt Walker, and the executive producer is Sam Barry. Catch you next time on Unsung.